everyone. I'm Grace.
And I'm Zoe,
the Dead Language Ladies.
So today's episode is, you think your family's dysfunctional? Just look at Oedipus. So we're specifically looking at Sophocles' plays, Antigone and Oedipus the King, or Oedipus Rex.
Or Oedipus Tyrannos in Greek.
Right. So who is, we should probably talk about Sophocles. Who is Sophocles?
Yeah, so Sophocles is an Athenian tragedian, one of the three surviving tragedians that we have from antiquity, along with the others. Aeschylus, who was a little bit before Sophocles, and Euripides, who was a little bit after slash at the same time as Sophocles. Sophocles is interesting, one of the most interesting, I think, of these three, because he was not just a playwright, but actually pretty politically active. He served as a general. The Athenian people elected him to be one of their 10 generals during the Peloponnesian War. And he was sort of associating with, you know, members of the political elite, not just as kind of, you know, a cultural, you know, a producer of cultural goods, but as, you know, an active participant in politics. So I think that makes it really interesting to read his plays, especially when they're on themes like war and kingship, which Oedipus has a lot to say about the nature of rule.
That kind of reminds me of Seneca being kind
of
involved in politics, but he's like writing these plays and also the letters on Stoicism, which are like feel like complete opposites. And then he's just like involved with this tyrant.
Yeah, like it raises all these questions about like, you know, should we like read political messages into these plays? Like, you know, did they write these plays as like, you know, an escape from political life, like totally disconnected? You know, why do they, you know, turn to kind of this cultural career? But Sophocles was super successful. He won first prize several times in the city Dionysia, which was a big theatrical competition. I mean, it was a religious festival that happened every year in Athens, but its main feature was this theatrical competition where three tragedians would write plays and then stage them kind of over a series of days. And the Athenian citizen body, along with some foreign diplomats, would come and watch them spend days just, you know, sitting on the slope of the Acropolis. Luckily, it happened in early spring, so it wouldn't have been like brutally hot, but and then the judges would pick a tragedian who had won. Interestingly, Sophocles did not win first prize with Oedipus Rex. It's difficult to say exactly why he didn't win. Like, I mean, the play that did win first prize that year hasn't survived, and we don't actually have a clear sense of like what kind of criteria the judges were looking for.
It's a little bit like the difference between a Nobel Prize winner and, or no, Pulitzer Prize winner and the fantasy novel that
exactly
just rocked the world publicly.
Yeah, exactly. It's like,
it's like, which one really is going to withstand,
yeah,
you know,
the test of time? Well, what's also interesting is that the reason that this particular play, these two, Oedipus Rex and Antigone, have survived is that they were part of the educational canon, like selected by the Byzantines. So like all throughout antiquity, more than just seven plays, which is what we have now, more than just seven plays by Sophocles were circulating and being copied and read and studied. But by the time the Byzantines came around, they decided to like narrow down the canon to seven from Aeschylus, seven from Sophocles, and seven from Euripides. And that would be, you know, what the little Byzantine school children studied and learned. And because of that selection.
And it hasn't changed.
No,
since.
We are still studying and learning them like little Byzantine school children. But again, we don't really know, like, it's hard to say why these seven plays in particular, like, how would they have compared to other plays? Something that's interesting that we can talk a little bit more about maybe when we get into the play is that Aeschylus too actually wrote plays about Oedipus. So this was not the only Oedipus play circulating in Athens at the time. Sophocles was definitely entering into kind of a competitive cultural market here.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating to think about all these questions, like, why does Oedipus survive? I mean, Oedipus is a name, I think, that most people, even if they don't really know what it is, they have heard
right,
of it,
Freud,
like the Oedipus
yeah.
complex. Like, it's a popular cultural
Absolutely.
Thing that still exists. So, and maybe that's because of how iconic, maybe certain features of the play that other mm-hmm. ladies didn't have. Maybe it was more dramatic, outrageous. I mean, who knows? We don't have the other ones to really compare it against.
I mean, this was Aristotle's favorite tragedy.
Maybe it's his
Maybe
fault.
Maybe it's Aristotle's fault. Maybe everything is Aristotle's fault. I think that's true. But yeah this
there's,
one,
there's an
I mean,
argument for
this
that.
Play in particular, definitely, I mean, if you've ever read it or seen it performed, you know that it's just, it's extremely powerful. The story and the language, it really stays with you. And I think, I mean, we're still here discussing it. I think Sophocles would be
we're talking
even
about
though
it
Sophocles
now.
Didn't win first prize, he
so that just goes to show you don't have to win
no
prizes.
You gotta play
to
the long game.
The weird thing about these, and we're going to focus on Antigone and Oedipus the King, or Oedipus Rex, the many names it has. Antigone just has Antigone. Antigone, okay, this is debated, but some say Antigone was written first and that Oedipus Rex was actually written later as a kind of prequel, but we actually have no idea, really.
Yeah, it's difficult right? because we don't... So Antigone, we have some pretty, I mean, relatively reliable evidence saying that it was performed around the year 440-ish, somewhere around there. Because we only have these seven plays of Sophocles, it's kind of, you know, it's hard to get a sense of like how he developed across his career. And we don't have solid performance dates for all of them. The type of analysis that they do to try to figure it out, it's very complicated. I personally could not do it myself, but it's based on like linguistic and metrical details, like, oh, you know, Sophocles, it seems, had these metrical features earlier in his career that then, you know, became less prevalent later on in his career and vice versa. Almost more like subconscious elements of his style that they're looking for. And based on that, some scholars have argued that Oedipus Rex comes fourth of the seven plays that we have in terms of like chronological composition order. And they place Antigone like first or second. The issue with that is we don't really know like how long of a stretch between Antigone and Oedipus Rex there was. Based on some details in the play, most notably the plague at the beginning, a lot of people want to see a relationship between the plague happening in the tragedy and a real life plague happening in Athens during the 430s BC.
Which is a compelling
it
argument.
It is. I think I'm not entirely convinced by it because the idea of a plague opening a work of literature, right? I mean, you have to think of the Iliad in that sense. We do know that there was a plague in Athens happening at this time. Thucydides writes about it. So it is tempting to see those parallels, and I think like there definitely is some resonance, but I personally think that the connection to the Iliad is more interesting and more compelling.
Stronger,
but that is
yeah.
to say, for that reason, there's a good argument to be made dating Oedipus Rex to the 430s, so about a decade after Antigone. But you will find people making convincing arguments for earlier and later. With tragedy, there's just so little reliable evidence, which is unfortunate because if we knew, we could, you know, make all sorts of more interesting insights, I think, into these tragedies. Like, you know, what is the, you know, nature of the relationship between Oedipus and like real life politicians in Athens? But because we don't know when it was written, it's hard to make conclusions like that.
So speaking of Oedipus and political situations.
He's in a bad one.
I mean, so we should probably give some myth history here, very briefly. His father, there's supposedly a curse on Laius, his father. We don't really get any of that in the play, but it's sort of generally known that he has this curse for violating hospitality. The Greeks had a hospitality culture that was really strong, and it was against Zeus to deny guests like your hospitality. And you see that a lot in Homer's work. Apparently, he forces himself onto the boy he's tutoring. When he's allowed to be a guest in the home of Pelops, King Pelops. And for that, there's a curse on him. And an oracle actually says that Laius is doomed to be killed by his son. So when Laius hears about this, of course, he's like, there's no way my son's going to kill me. So when Jocasta, his wife, has Oedipus, he wants to kill him, binds his ankles, and tells Jocasta to kill him, which is the number one mistake, that he left that up to his wife, the mother of that child. Jocasta couldn't do it, so she gave it to a shepherd, and the shepherd was supposed to leave it out to die or kill it, and he couldn't do it either. And eventually, that baby Oedipus gets adopted by Polybus and Merope in Corinth, and they raise him as their own, so he doesn't know that he's adopted, which is probably a theme in itself. And then he learns that he's destined to sleep with his mother and kill his father, which is like the famous curse upon him. And so, thinking that his parents are in Corinth, he leaves Corinth. But on his way away from Corinth to Thebes, he comes to a crossroads where he encounters an old man, and they get into an argument, and he kills the old man, and that old man was his father. And so he unknowingly kills his father.
Road rage is so ancient.
So then he heads to Thebes, and I think this is where my summary is really sketching this out. He has this whole thing with the Sphinx where...
Right, this...
The Sphinx, you know, the riddle.
He solves the riddle. What walks on...
He solves the riddle. The riddle is the famous one of like the
four legs in the what walks on four legs four in the morning, legs. Three legs in the afternoon. No, two legs in the afternoon and three legs in the evening, and it's infancy, youth slash adulthood, and then old age when you need a cane.
So mortal mortals. And he answers it right, and I think the Sphinx actually like throws herself off like a cliff or something when that happens. And he's rewarded with Jocasta, who's the queen of Thebes, and coincidentally, or not so coincidentally, his mother. So he marries his mother and sleeps with her and has four kids with her. But then, that's all just backstory that you don't even get into in the play at the beginning. So you open on the scene, there's a plague in Thebes where Oedipus is king, and he learns that he can only end it by finding out Laius's murder, the former king, and, you know,
expelling the murderer from the city. Yeah, it's like I think the Greek word that they use is miasma, like a stain, a pollution on the city.
So there's this really interesting conversation, and we were talking about this, between Oedipus and Creon that you sort of forget about because there's a lot going on that's more relevant, like him finding out about his mother and father. But there is this question of Creon's loyalty at the beginning, because Creon's the one who goes to the oracle, and the oracle tells him that they need to like expel this person, and Oedipus is like, why are you doing this to me? Like, you want the kingship, and they're like fighting and fighting and fighting. And then that prompts Jocasta to come out of the palace and be like, boys, stop fighting. Like, what's going on? I'm sure I can resolve this. And Oedipus is like, your brother's accusing me, because Creon's Jocasta's brother. And he's like, your brother is accusing me of, like, or telling me that I need to, like, actually, I don't know if Creon, I think Creon actually might have told him that it was him.
Yes.
I don't know if he, I think he was told, actually, by the Oracle that it was Oedipus.
Yeah, at this point, like, Oedipus is resisting the accusation.
Yeah, he's resisting. He says, this is what I've learned. And he's like, you're wrong. You're trying to get my spot as king. And Jocasta's like, okay, why is he telling you that? I'm sure there's, like, some reason, like, what's going on. And then Oedipus is like, okay, we need to talk to
Tiresias. Yeah.
The blind seer who knows everything, actually. Mm-hmm. Which is an interesting character to have. It's hard to have a character that knows everything. Because it's the way that then the way he gives information,
right?
The truth,
Tiresias,
he's, like, obsessed with.
He doesn't want to tell Oedipus. And here, I think, with the concept of Tiresias knowing everything but being blind, I think is a good place to talk about Oedipus's name, which So, like, the actual, I mean, Oedipus is a super archaic name, like already in Homer, right? Like, you know, we see his name. So it has a pretty deep etymology. But what this name would evoke for a Greek audience in the 5th century. So the oida part of his name looks similar to a verb that means to swell. And the pus part comes from the Greek word pus, meaning foot. So literally, Oedipus can mean swollen foot, which refers to the way that his feet were bound.
As a baby, when he was cast out. Clarify, yeah.
There's also another interesting etymology, you know, whether or not it's, like, the actual, you know, real source of his name. It sounds like it's related to the Greek verb oida, which has an interesting double meaning of to know something, but also to see something. And I think Oedipus really plays on the ambiguity of this, Oedipus the play, because, right, Tiresias, he can't see, but he knows everything. And there is a lot of language of, like, you know, metaphorical blindness and things coming to light as Oedipus learns, you know, the truth of his birth. But then also when Oedipus will blind himself, spoiler alert, if you didn't know that, it's like once he finally knows the truth, he can no longer see physically. So there is, like, within his name, he kind of encompasses both the seeing and the knowing. But as the play literally performs, it draws this sharp distinction between seeing and knowing.
And the conversation they have is really interesting. It's a lot of allusions to this kind of name double meaning and the comparison between, or juxtaposition between, Oedipus being having eyes and being able to see, but being utterly blind to his situation, and then Tiresias being blind, but knowing all too well Oedipus's situation, and not wanting to, he doesn't want to anger the king. Right. He doesn't want to, you know, tell him what's going on, because it's going to be sad for him and for them. But Oedipus, in his pride, thinks he knows everything. So he's like, no, no, you're going to tell the truth. And so Tiresias says, you know, well, you've killed you're going to kill your father and sleep with your mother. Well, you already have. Oh, Creon and Oedipus have that conversation after Tiresias comes.
Right.
And Oedipus asks Creon, so, like, how long ago was it that Laius died? He starts asking these sort of, like, innocent, offhanded questions, like, you know, just curious.
By the way,
like, and he's like, oh, you know, yeah, this many years ago. And Oedipus is like, hey, that was, like, way before I was here. He's like, and then Creon says, well, they have this argument about, like, you know, I should be able, Creon wants to be able to give his opinion. And Oedipus is like, I'm the king, like, you know, Don't tell me what I should do. And then Jocasta comes out and is like, what's going on? You know, don't make any more trouble. And then Oedipus asks, how did he die? And Jocasta was like, it was so long ago. It was at this crossroads. Blah, 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 blah. And Oedipus is like, you say crossroads. Like, what kind of crossroads? Like, where? And she's like, oh, it was like right here, this area. I would have to find it to remember. But it was the same area. Spoiler alert. And Oedipus is like, oh, that area? Like, what did he look like? And it just slowly comes out. He's like, oh, shoot.
Mm-hmm.
I might have murdered my father. Like, that's his sort of realization. But then the messenger comes out and is like, well, we just got news that your father died in Thebes. And he's like, oh my God, so I couldn't have killed my father. He's dead over there and I'm here. And the shepherd who came, the messenger, he's like, no, no, no. Actually, fun fact, you're not even their kid. They adopted you. So you don't have to worry about sleeping with your mother, Merope, because she's actually not even your mother. And he's like, what do you mean? And she's like, the guy's like, yeah, I gave you to them from a shepherd that had you and was needed to give you away as a baby. And it's at this moment that Jocasta and the audience, I think, at the same time, really connects the dots in a real way. And Jocasta starts to be like,
let's wrap this up.
Okay, I think we should stop. Let's stop asking questions. Like, we're done now. Let's send him away and let's go back to normal life. And Oedipus is like, no, no, no. I'm like, I need to hunt for this guy. There's a plague and these are things. And I think he starts to know in his heart the truth.
Yeah, I mean, what's so tragic about Oedipus, like, the reason that all this happens to him is because he wants to be a good leader. And he wants to figure out, like, you know, like, he's doing all this to solve the plague for his people. And ultimately, like, I mean, by the end of the play, like, we've kind of moved away from the idea that the people are suffering. But
doesn't get mentioned once.
We don't really care about, you know, anyone outside this family by the end of the play. But, like, Sophocles has framed it in such a way that Oedipus's, like, ultimate tragic flaw is that he just wants to get to the truth. And, like, you know, how can you blame him for that? Like, you know, we all just want answers.
I mean, and I think the blame, where the gods are blaming him, because they do blame him, because he is, you know, he did commit something. It's a curse on the family, supposedly, but he also he acts like he knows everything. He believes he knows everything. He thinks as king that he can really see and fix everything. And it's sort of that blindness. It almost feels allegorical, but it's like, it's so enwrapped in his story that it I think that's why it survives the test of time, is like, it is so particular to Oedipus, but at the same time, it speaks to that universal truth that you can be a king, you can be wealthy, you can be, have all this power, you can know everything. And yet, lo and behold, you killed your father and slept with your mother and you don't even know it. Like, that's how blind mortals can be. I think that's the idea, is like, and there's a kind of warning, and the Greeks are always really good with these very negative warnings about mortals. Like, you think you know everything, you think your life's so good.
No.
Just wait. The gods have something else in store for you.
And what's so crazy too is that, like, the gods, like, they don't appear on stage at all in this tragedy. Like, I mean, think about, like, you know, Aeschylus's Oresteia, where, like, the gods literally come on stage and they're, like, you know, having this trial scene and debating with each other. Like, Sophocles could have chosen to do that. Like, he could have chosen Apollo to come on stage and, like, reveal these things. But I think what makes it, like, so powerful is that it all happens through the human interaction. And it's like, it sort of makes you feel like, oh, like, this could happen to me. Like, this is, like, just in its content, like, it feels so plausible. And I think, like, paradoxically, because the gods don't appear, it makes it all the more affecting and powerful as a play.
I mean, there's a great, that reminds me of this line that Tiresias says, like, it is not fate that I should be your ruin. Apollo is enough. It is his care to work this out. Then Oedipus, was this your own design or Creon's? Refusing to believe that a god's involved. Tiresias, Creon is no hurt to you, but you are to yourself. And the next thing Oedipus says is this long thing, so I won't say the whole thing, but he starts out, wealth, kingly rule, and skill outmatching skill for the contrivance of an envied life. How great a store of jealousy you are holding. Hoarding, if for the sake of the office which I hold, given blah, 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 like, you're secretly attacking me, for who has only eyes for his own gains, but blindness in his skill, which is so ironic. Mm-hmm. I mean, Tiresias must be listening to this, like, cringing, yeah. Like, oh, you think you're blind? You don't, like, you think I'm blind? You don't even know. You think you can see and you can't see anything. But he literally says that, like, wealth, kingly rule, and skill outmatching skill, because remember, he has the cleverness too. Mm-hmm. He answered the riddles, the Sphinx riddle. So there is that element. And that's, like, common in a lot of tragedies in Greece. It's like this fall from grace, right? It's like even the high, the elite of the elite. You can't escape your fate. You can't escape the wrath of the mm-hmm. gods or mm-hmm. their plans. You're not outside of it. And I think if you think about it, people are fascinated with that. The idea, like, you know, imagine them watching a play, and it's like the idea that someone so kingly mm-hmm. can have such a fall. I mean, we see it with Agamemnon. We see it with all these people. They love that idea. So it's interesting.
So should we talk about Oedipus's ending? What happens when he does fall?
So once the herdsman says the deal of how it all happened, you know, Oedipus, oh, they will all come out clearly. Light of the sun, let me look upon you no more after today. And so, meanwhile, Jocasta has sort of disappeared into the palace. And this is sort of a device they use sometimes where the woman or someone disappears, is very quiet in the palace, and they're like, suspicious. So he goes in, and he learns that Jocasta killed herself. And so he goes into the room where she's hanged herself, takes the brooches or the fibulae from the dress, the clips, basically. So the ancient Greek dresses, they have these brooches at the top of the shoulder where they pin together the two sides of the mm-hmm. dress up onto the shoulder. So he takes those two and gouges out his eyes so that he can no longer see. And I was telling Grace my theory, like, it's so ironic that even in this moment where Oedipus is reckoning with the fact that he killed his father and slept with his mother, when he goes to see his mother / wife dead, of course, the way that he chooses to gouge his eyes out is to use the brooches that pin up her dress. And so if he did that, like, the dress would go down.
Right.
So it'd basically, like, make her naked, which is, like, so ironic for someone who's, like, he couldn't have just, gouged his eyes out with, like, utensils or anything normal. No. He had to undress his dead mother / wife.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Which I think had to be purposeful.
It's so symbolic and metaphorical and significant. And, I mean, it's, like, this small detail that, like, when Zoe brought it up to me, like, I had never thought about it or, like, drawn out the implications. But I think it, like, details like this, I think, testify to why this play has survived for over 2 millennia. Because, like, there's just so much richness to it and so many details that you pick up on new things every single time that you read it. It really never gets old.
So the ending, all of these plays have a kind of, like, choral ending. And this one has the famous line, count no mortal happy till he has passed the final limit of his life secure from pain. There's different ways to translate that. Another way is, like, no man should be considered fortunate until he is dead, which is so, It's mm-hmm. so true. Mm-hmm. Especially yeah, Oedipus.
Had it pretty good for a while. But
yeah, it's a warning. It's and, you know, in thinking that a lot of these people watching were probably elites and not necessarily the lowest class that there is. I mean, there were, I mean, everyone came to watch it. I'm pretty sure that they allowed not just men. I think women were allowed. They maybe had different areas to sit.
It's heavily debated. Yeah, I mean, like, we don't know, like, actually who comprised the audience, like, definitively, but essentially, like, the Athenian citizen population. So that sort of excludes, like, the medics, the foreign residents who didn't have citizenship, were slaves in the audience is another question. But yes, that is to say, there were a lot of elites in this audience. And I mean, the whole question of, like, you know, what is the relationship between tragedy and, you know, Athenian democracy? It's also very heavily debated in scholarship. That's kind of a theme of tragedy, is that everyone has a different take on it. There's very little that is actually agreed upon and known definitively. But it is definitely a message to the audience. Like, you couldn't come away from this play without, I think, you know, being a little bit afraid for the future.
There's also a weird theme about fate here. And it's I think it's hard for us to quite wrap our minds around it, because we have this idea of free will, which I don't think any ancient authors ever really considered as a possibility. The gods were just so pervasive, and there were forces at play that they didn't understand and that we still don't.
Right.
But we like to think,
I mean, even in, like, in texts that don't talk about the gods directly, like, there is this strong sense of, like, necessity, right? The Greek word ananke is, like, almost a divine force in its own right. There is, like, you know, whether or not it's the gods, there is, like, a sense of things happening in a certain way because this is just how they have to happen. Yeah, definitely less free will than we conceptualize.
And it's something to do a little bit with their identity too, as a person. And I think with Oedipus, for me, my big thing is, if you knew you were destined to kill your father and sleep with your mother, why didn't you abstain from all relationships and murder? Like, never murder someone, maybe. How about? Even if it meant they murdered you. Like, even, you know, because it wasn't really self-defense. That's the thing about him at the crossroads. It wasn't, no. Like, I mean, the guy was gonna maybe, like, I think he hit him with his scepter or something. I think that's what the myth says. And then he was like, kill. And then he goes, oh, I'm gonna get married. Like, you don't think I would be a little more, I wouldn't be so, I guess, prideful, like egotistical, thinking that I could outwit the gods. I would be like, okay, I'm not doing anything.
He thought that he knew, like, he had, but at the same time, like, you know, I think that makes him much more of a relatable character to the audience. And it makes his tragedy that much scarier, because it's like, okay, like, you know, your parents never told you you're adopted, so you assume that you're their biological child. Like, why would you ever think differently? So then, you know, you leave and you think, like, okay, everything's fine. Like, I'm just gonna live my life. And it's like, yeah, if you frame it that way, like, it's a pretty reasonable thing to do. Like, yes, like, you shouldn't murder people, but that's, like, a separate issue. But, like, then when you consider the rest of Oedipus's story, like, it kind of, like, throws into question, like, you know, when does just, you know, normal human life end up bleeding into hubris against the gods? And it's kind of scary that there is no clear distinction between them.
And that's all we have time for today.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Dead Language Ladies.
And stay tuned for our next episode.
Wale.
Haide.